And if we can make handwriting easier and more automatic for our students, then they can use that brain power for higher level skills.
Hey there, and welcome back to another episode of the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. So happy to have you here today. The day that this is being released is actually National Handwriting Day, so it is only fitting that we do have an episode about handwriting today. A few weeks ago, we talked about dysgraphia, and in this episode, we are talking with Cheryl Bregman, creator of the Handwriting Heroes app. That was Cheryl that you actually heard leading into my intro today, and that's a very powerful statement that she said there. She's basically saying that if we help students to better understand the physical act of writing, even the mental act of actually getting legible letters, legible sentences on the page, then they can use their brain for higher level activities. Think maybe writing longer paragraphs, entire essays, or maybe even doing other things while writing, like listening to the teacher or following whatever's going on the board. So I'm super excited today to bring on Cheryl Bregman. She's going to talk to us all about handwriting and maybe some of those old school traditions that maybe we need to rethink a little bit. Things like starting with uppercase letters and maybe about spacing and whatnot. We're going to talk about some of those age-old traditions and maybe how we can rethink what we are doing with our students. So let's go ahead and cue the intro music. And as soon as we come back, we will jump into our interview with Cheryl Bregman.
Hello and welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast, your source for school-based occupational therapy tips, interviews, and professional development. Now, to get the conversation started, here is your host, Jason Davies. Class is officially in session.
Cheryl, welcome to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. How are you doing today?
Hi, Jason. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm just excited to have you here as well. We're talking about handwriting today. More importantly, I'm excited because we're going to talk a little bit about some age-old traditions that maybe aren't always the best examples, and then maybe follow up with some better ideas and some better things. But first, I have to acknowledge your beautiful, wonderful sleeping dog behind you. I know everyone listening to the podcast can't see him, but he's just adorable back there.
Thank you. That's Milo. He's a sheepadoodle and my constant companion there.
I love it. I like to say this is a dog-friendly podcast, so I'm excited to have him here with us today. All right. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You are an occupational therapist, but tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, I've been working in pediatrics for the past 25 years in schools and in private practice, and particularly with children with learning disabilities and dysgraphia. I've also loved product and curriculum design, and I came up with a method for teaching handwriting that my students really responded to. I subsequently worked with animators and musicians, developers, artists to develop what is now a rather robust handwriting program called Handwriting Heroes.
Wow. And so you've developed that over basically 20 years of experience, it sounds like.
Exactly. It's been, you know, a labor of love.
I know the feels. Definitely, right? You, whenever you create something from the ground up, we've been there. We've started with nothing and now we have something, and it just feels good, doesn't it?
That's wonderful, especially, you know, to see it sort of almost being completed. Yeah. Right. You know, it will never quite be done because, you know, I'm a revisionist at heart and always keep refining things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, again, this is not a question I plan to ask you, but I know from my experience with the OT Schoolhouse that this program, the OT Schoolhouse in general, has allowed me to have conversations that I never would have had, to talk to people all around the world. And so I want to ask you, with the Handwriting Heroes, you know, do you recall any specific email or any chat where someone was just so appreciative and really just was excited about your product and wanted to share that with you?
I've had a lot of, specifically from mothers, actually, whose children have been, you know, first-time writers and who haven't, you know, ever been successful at writing prior. I think they're incredibly grateful, and where, especially when they, you know, their children have been completely averse to writing and now they love writing. So that's a huge compliment. And, you know, I love hearing from them. I just recently saw an Instagram post from a parent who I don't know, but it was amazing how she shows the child just, and she says something to the effect of handwriting heroes has got this child dedicated to saying the letters correctly. And that's a big deal.
Wow. So not even necessarily writing, just saying the letters correctly. Is that what you just said?
Right. Well, saying the letter stories, actually.
Gotcha.
So he happens to be, you know, you can see him in the video and he's holding the different, it looks like cardboard letters and doing the different strokes related to the letter stories, saying, I skydive down and get its dot on top. And very animated and just lovely to see that.
I love that. That's awesome. You know, we are going to dive more into that. I'd love to hear more about the letter stories. That sounds great. I love that you're putting storytelling into the writing process. That's awesome. And we'll get into that in just a bit. But I wanted to start off this podcast by I kind of alluded to it a little bit ago, but digging into some of those age-old trends that have been around handwriting that we all have heard at some point or another with school-age children, that maybe some of the research that you've done has kind of debunked that. And so I just want to ask you about what are a few things that are common practice that maybe you're flipping the script on?
Well, there's a couple. The first trend relates to OTs feeling like they're handwriting teachers and that this role is somehow demeaning. If you consider the fact that handwriting automaticity is the most important predictor of length and quality of written composition in elementary school, and that 30 to 60% of each school day involves handwriting, we may want to reconsider how we feel about our involvement in handwriting. And that's not to say that the status quo is ideal or there aren't ways to improve it. The next trend that I want to mention is that of teaching uppercase first. In the context of today's classroom, where kindergarten students are expected to write from early on, I feel that we really do need to think about starting with lowercase, particularly for students with learning disabilities.
Yeah, why specific to learning disabilities?
I saw that my students who had learning disabilities, when they were older, they had a really hard time with differentiating between upper and lowercase. They were often writing only in uppercase, sort of stuck in that mode and still mixing the two scripts. So when one teaches lowercase first, gets that automatic, and then teaches uppercase, you don't run into that issue because they have their lowercase cemented.
Yeah. And as I think about that and wrap my head about it more, we do use more lowercase than we do use uppercase, right? Uppercase we use at the Absolutely. Beginning of a sentence or with a proper noun, but typically we're using lowercase unless it's the Exactly. letter I in a word. So, yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So it's a really functional script that teachers are needing kids to use sooner rather than later.
Gotcha. Okay. So we talked about, first of all, was OTs, you know, being the handwriting teacher and having a little bit of a bias against that or whatever you want to call it. I want to come back to that. I do. But then the second one was using lowercase letters. What else have you found?
Well, I also think there's a trend to do sensory motor training to address handwriting problems. And really, research has shown that this bottom-up approach that works on the underlying skills, so midline crossing, fine motor control, pencil grasp, and so on, it's not as effective as direct, explicit handwriting practice. And I feel like we need to get away from feeling as though we need to do those underlying skills for handwriting remediation.
Okay. And I feel like that one really ties back to that first one that I wanted to jump back into, right? Is handwriting versus using the sensory motor approach. Sometimes those kind of go hand in hand. Some people want to do the direct handwriting instruction, or they want to do the sensory motor approach, or vice versa. And exactly. So I want to dive into those two concepts a little bit more, because whenever I hear someone say, we're not handwriting teachers, right? And I agree, we're not necessarily handwriting teachers, but 20, 30 years ago, we would have loved to have been called the handwriting teacher because we were not even in the schools. We would have loved to get into the schools. And I think that has gotten us into those schools, but now we're so overworked and we're so bogged down that we're trying to almost pull away from it because we're getting every single student that has a handwriting concern, and it's a little overwhelming for people. So I want to ask you to elaborate a little bit more on that, what you mean by our role in the schools with handwriting. Should we be doing more direct OT with students, one-to-one with handwriting? Should we provide more of a consultative role? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a sort of complex question.
Oh,
and
yes,
we have been working a lot with one-on-one sessions or small groups and not working enough in a collaborative model with the teacher. So I feel like we should be co-teaching with the teacher, showing best practices, modeling, and showing how multisensory teaching assists handwriting, and slowly really move the responsibility of teaching handwriting back into the hands of teachers. And there's also a sense that we're responsible for all handwriting, and that's come to bear primarily because of Common Core and teachers feeling overwhelmed themselves. They're struggling to fit the curriculum in that they need to fit in. And so they've given handwriting a side shift, unfortunately, unfortunately for students. And they're now, those kids who may not have had handwriting problems do, because I actually call it a pseudodysgraphia, where because they have not had the instruction that they needed in handwriting, they now have a pseudo disability or a so-called disability that they wouldn't have had if it weren't for direct explicit instruction that the teacher provided. So it's something where I feel like the occupational therapist can guide the teachers. We just have to take more control of that role and modify it to suit ourselves, not to suit ourselves, but to suit the scenario, and help the teacher reincorporate handwriting, but still be very much involved. And especially when it comes to the kids who have the true disabilities, where we can assist and, you know, provide more intervention and more strengthening. So just a more collaborative model would be helpful in that scenario.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I mean, just to kind of flip the role, right? If 90% of our referrals were coming for a student using scissors, we'd probably be saying to all the teachers, we're not scissor cutting therapists, right?
Yes.
But we are occupational therapists. And as you alluded to, students are handwriting 30-60% of the day, depending on their grade level. And there is research out there that shows that. I know that research now is starting to get a little bit older and maybe kids are using more technology, but still, they are definitely writing in the classroom. And so that is a very important occupation. But I think as we continue on, you're going to share with us even more about how the benefits that handwriting can have potentially over typing. And I think that's also important to remember when we're in an IEP and we're considering when to maybe transition away from handwriting to typing or vice versa. So yeah, thanks for elaborating on the collaboration.
Right. And I'll clarify, Jason, I think handwriting is still very much part of the elementary classroom. What has happened to make things sort of worse is COVID, and where there was the span of 2 years ultimately where the kids were not on, not using paper and pencil, and they were on their Chromebooks or their desktops. And now we're seeing kids, even in third grade, who cannot handwrite whatsoever. And schools are really struggling. And obviously OTs are struggling with their caseloads. And it's...
Yeah. And I think that kind of lends itself to that term that you use, that pseudodysgraphia, because they weren't... Mm-hmm. It's not that they necessarily have dysgraphia, but like you said, they're in front of a computer for 2-3 years and all they did was try and type. So they haven't had the experience. Yeah, definitely.
Right. Yeah.
Cool. So just to recap really quickly, we talked about the gripe that some OTs have with handwriting or being the handwriting teacher per se. We talked a little bit about sensory motor. Let's dive into that one a little bit actually more. I know there's research out there, and you kind of alluded to it, right, where sensory motor approaches don't necessarily lead to handwriting improvements. Personally, when I'm working with students, a lot of times we do a sensory motor type of warm-up or something like that. Is that something that is fair game, or what's your take on using sensory motor within intervention?
Absolutely. I think that the more can be incorporated with the handwriting activity, the better. We're working oftentimes with so-called low-tone children who haven't got the muscle strength or the dexterity to coordinate activities. They've got, you know, possibly generalized motor planning difficulties. So depending on their goals, you can, you know, hit a number of those goals with sensory motor activities. But, you know, ultimately, you have to have that direct handwriting practice. Without that practice, it's not going to get better. And also to incorporate more sensory motor activities within the handwriting. So for example, using a thumbtack to pin punch letters, that would be a great way to incorporate fine motor skills and a handwriting task. So as long as, you know, you're not sort of straying too far away and assuming that by working with therapy, you're going to make substantial handwriting gains.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you were saying that, I love that because that's definitely something I've done, right? Using something to poke holes to make letters or whatever it might be. I've used toothpicks, right? You can kind of hold it like a pencil. Yes. and poke holes. On the flip side, I've done the opposite too, where I've taken the letter producing out of it, but kept the pencil in it, right? We've all think about like coloring activities. You're taking the writing out mm-hmm. of it, but you're still using a crayon, a writing utensil. But also I've done things where it's just like pencil activities, but has nothing to do with actually putting the pencil on the paper. So just getting them used to a pencil, like we'll do little like pencil flips. Can you yes. twist the pencil from your thumb and your index finger to your thumb and your pinky, right? Doing opposition, right. Different activities. So I think that could be a great warm-up. You're still at least using the writing tool, which eventually, of course, is a process of writing.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, it reminds me, there's like a small video, like a caterpillar inchworm that you sort of scooch your fingers up.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. And then the rotation. So absolutely using those to improve the dexterity, and that comes into play when you're erasing or when you're then, you know, flipping, and it makes it more efficient. But to your point where you said taking the pencil out of the writing, that's completely valid. And I will say that for younger children or children who have got significant impairments where they're not ready for paper pencil tasks, I will often do sensory motor activities or air writing in order for them to teach the letter form or the letter formation without even touching a paper and pencil. So they have got confidence to learn that letter. They know the letter story even before they've touched a pencil and paper. And it just gives them confidence that it takes away the anxiety, firstly, of the paper-pencil task, because they've often had negative connotations with that. Or there's a sense of permanency when you're writing with paper and pencil, that mark is there for everyone to see, and it's embarrassing for the kids who can't yeah. write. Yeah. And you take that away, you separate the processes, and it makes for a much happier child who's suddenly prepared to work on handwriting, even though they don't know they're working on handwriting.
Yeah, definitely. Great. I want to jump into pencil grasp, but before I do that, I want to ask you, are there any other age-old traditions, age-old adages that that you wanted to address before we move on?
Not that I can think of right now. There are, but...
Yeah. No, yeah. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about handwriting in this podcast. So
sure.
we'll get into more things. When pencil grip comes up, I feel like we are moving more toward the trend that is common knowledge that you don't need a perfect pencil grip to write functionally. I know just a few weeks ago, Taylor Swift's video, her new music video, which is trending like crazy, right? Because she used a cross quadrilateral something grip. I don't even remember. I didn't watch the video. But, you know, that's coming out. And so what's your take on pencil grips?
Right. I saw that on social media as well. But also didn't watch the video. But from a research perspective, they've also shown that it's not that important. And again, like if you have a child with weak muscles and their pencil grip is going to reflect that, the child essentially isn't defying you or choosing to hold their pencil incorrectly. So they can't magically change that just because you're asking them to. And if you think about the reason that we want a functional grasp, it's essentially to prevent pain and fatigue when writing. So if a student has a fixed grasp and gets pain when they're writing, then I'll often show them an alternate grasp like the stenographer's grasp, or I'll encourage them to use pencil grips. And I'm not asking the child to change their grip, but rather to use a different grasp, even if it's for a short period of time, to give the overworked muscles a break. And that's often the case with older students where they're coming to me saying, my hand is fatiguing, I can't write for long periods of time, can't keep up.
That was a great little nugget. I don't think I've ever worked with a student and asked them to use a different pencil grip temporarily. And I like what you just said, especially for those older students, right? They know that their hand is bugging them. They just need like a break. And so how can we give their hand a break without breaking away from the writing process per se, right? They need to get their work done. They can't take an extended break. But can they just hold the pencil a little bit different that is still functional for them and take that, give their whatever finger 5 minute break because they're using a slightly different grasp. Correct. I like that.
Correct. It just gives them that pause, but they're still continuing to work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even when I think about that, I mean, it just brings up so many ideas because you could work with a teacher and, you know, a lot of writing, especially for older students, isn't pencil to paper. A lot of it is planning. And so, you know what, maybe you're taking a break from writing, but you're doing a slightly different part of the assignment. If they really do need a complete break from writing, right? Maybe they're just doing a different part of the writing process per se.
Right. I often, you know, say to my truly dysgraphic children who are usually boys, that all they need is, you know, a good secretary. So to assist in the classroom and, you know, get the work done.
Yeah. And you know what? Siri is coming a long way right now. Mm-hmm. If you're listening, we have something that's recording us right now. You know, Zoom has transcription into it. And there's a lot of technology out there that can help people with their difficulties. We all use technology nowadays and we all use it to amplify our own abilities. So why should we prevent students from doing similar activities?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the next question I kind of wanted to dive in with you, because I know your program isn't completely about writing, there's also some reading components with language. And so I wanted to ask you how reading and writing collide to impact each other.
Sure. So for reading, writing a letter helps one to learn its shape and spatial orientation. And this letter perception contributes to better reading. It helps to connect letter symbol and letter names and sounds. So I've often heard OT say that if a child can't read, then we don't need to teach them how to handwrite. And I really consider that a missed opportunity because I've had so many instances where learning to write has been a starting point, a jumping off point for a child's reading. And it's a safe place to start from. And learning perhaps from a position of strength where they now know how to form the letter L, they know that the letter L landed on a lemon, and there's that, firstly, the alliteration, they've learned the letter name, they've learned the letter, what the letter sound makes, and then there's that causal sort of relationship where it extends into just knowing the alphabetic principle, and it gives the child more confidence when they're posed with perhaps something that's even harder being reading. Yeah, and then when it comes to writing, it's important to recognize that all the skills that go into writing, we don't often think about them. But you have to think about, like, the child's thinking about what they want to say, how to spell the words, how to organize a sentence. And then on top of that, they have to work out how to form the letters, where the letters go on the line, which way they face, how hard to press the pencil. So it's really taxing on one's working memory. And if we can make handwriting easier and more automatic for our students, then they can use that brain power for higher level skills. But for handwriting to become automatic, the letters must be formed in the most efficient way. And I don't think that's often realized.
Yeah. And I really, you know, as you say that, the last little part that you said, you know, I think of those kids where we pull them aside or the teacher pulls them aside and they can write neatly one sentence. And then when they go back to their desk to write a paragraph, it's just gone. Like, it's just a hot mess again. Right. And that's because they haven't really automated the process. You know, when they're really thinking about legibility, they can make it happen. But when they're thinking about the assignment that they're supposed to be writing about, To Kill a Mockingbird or whatever it is that they're writing a paragraph about, they're not worried about letter formation, spacing, sizing, all that good stuff. They're worried about getting the words from their head onto the page in some way.
Right. And they can't devote that working memory, that attention to letter formation in that instance. So that's why the letter formation component falls apart. They've only got so much reserve. And unless it's automatized, we're going to have a child whose handwriting deteriorates at that point.
Yeah. So I want to push on this. I like this topic that we're at right here. And so OTs, I have had conversations with OTs. I mean, I've been in that conundrum state of mind too. I'm like, what do I do with this student, right? They can write legibly when they're with me, but they go back to class, it's not legible. Do I discharge the student? Do I put them on consult? Do I continue direct? What have you found for you, what has worked with some of your students? I know it does. What works with one student works with one student, but is there something that you found that kind of helps with that, I guess, automatic writing, I guess we could call it?
Sure. So a couple of things I just want to mention that you touched on there. One being, potentially we shouldn't be working alone in a room with a student because it's just not a functional scenario. They're not producing schoolwork in that scenario. So when we see them and they can write legibly, that's a false narrative, essentially.
I agree.
Because you've taken away all distractions and you're making it essentially non-functional, but you're coming up with a result that is wonderful, and you're being able to then say, look, you know, I've got this wonderful result. My student's legible. He doesn't need OT. Not the case. Only in a functional environment, if we get a functional example of legibility and speed, then we can discharge that student, or then we should think about discharging that student. It's function, you know, can't be defined just by legibility. Anyone can write legibly. Even a dysgraphic student can write legibly with a lot of cognitive energy and with a lot of effort put into that letter formation. But take that ability for him to, you know, focus that hard and to devote that much attention to letter formation, and put him back in the classroom, it's not a functional scenario anymore. So the second thing you asked was whether I found, you know, interventions possibly that could address that. So for a lot of students, what helps is working on automaticity with alphabet sequencing. So I do a lot of handwriting where the child, and I'll sort of motivate them to write the alphabet with good formation, but quickly. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll put a stopwatch on we'll graph the, you know, decrease in speed. Or I've even used like a fidget spinner, and I spin the fidget spinner and they have to do it faster than the fidget spinner goes.
I love that.
They love that. And, you know, I've got a fantastic decreases in speed because of that. same thing. I've got egg timers with different speeds that they run out just to make it more of a game. But that said, doing that alphabet repeatedly, and then also I do pangrams, so where they write sentences that have got all the letters in the alphabet, just to improve, you're trying to improve the speed that they're forming the letters mm-hmm. in an efficient way. And that's why we want correct letter formation. It's not because, you know, we're being pedantic and saying this is, you know, something I, you know, insist upon. It's because it's writing a letter consistently and in the best sequence shows improved speed. So just and also practice. Just 5 to 10 minutes of practice. I'll say the kids whose families I work with in private practice who do that practice, it's a substantial difference, you know, relative to the kids who don't.
Yeah.
They're developing that muscle memory and improving their speed. But I'll also say that they have to be practicing correct letter formation. There's a phrase, precise practice makes perfect. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yeah. I've always heard, you know, practice makes permanent, not perfect, unless you're doing it right, right?
Exactly. Right way. Whereas, you know, practice makes permanent. They're, you know, writing year after year, day, and so much of their day is filled with writing that when they write with bad habits, those are going to become permanent.
Exactly. So, you know, two things that kind of came to my mind as you were talking. As I kind of alluded to you as we were jumping on the call, I like to think about what John, Jessica, whoever's listening to this podcast, what they might want to ask based upon what you said. And one of the things that I have struggled with at times is having a child write the alphabet as quickly as they can, is that a therapeutic intervention, right? Like, what is the difference between us asking a student to write the alphabet quicker than a spinner can run out of spinning? Or, you know, how is that a therapeutic intervention? Because I'm on the same page as you, but I want to hear your idea. Why is it something for the OT to do and not something for the parent to do?
Right, or for the teacher, for that matter.
Yeah.
Sure. And I think there's a distinction between what I would consider the 70 to 80% of children who can learn with given a systematic structured intervention, program. Mm-hmm. Those children with, you know, that teacher's direction are going to learn to write, and with practicing activities, practicing words and phrases, they're going to improve their automaticity and their speed. And then the OTs, I feel like, are responsible for those, you know, let's say, you know, children who really do struggle and need more.
Yeah, the 10, 20%, whatever it might be.
Exactly. So I think, you know, but ultimately, we're not born with the ability to read and write. It's not innate, and it has to be taught. And so it has to, you know, do with more differentiation and finding out who actually needs the OT intervention and who needs that additional creativity that we offer, or the repetition, or the multisensory learning strategies. That's the distinction that should be made.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, as occupational therapists, you alluded to it, right? We're doing an evaluation to determine what area we need to work on. And we mm-hmm. might find that it's not a visual perceptual difficulty that the student has. Maybe it's a visual motor or vice versa, whatever it might be. Absolutely. But that is leading us to choose this intervention as opposed to something else. And to be quite honestly, I had never thought about doing that activity that you had talked about. And I'm an occupational therapist, so I don't know how many teachers out there have thought about doing something like that. And then the way that you implement it, I think, is different from the way that someone who is not an OT might implement it. So absolutely, I really like that idea. I'm going to steal that one. But do you also, as an occupational therapist, maybe you're doing that, you're timing the child, right? Getting them to race themselves, per se. Do you also provide that as a sort of quote unquote homework. I know something that you mentioned was that 5 to 10 minute practice. Unfortunately, especially as a school-based OTs, right? We're typically seeing a kid at most once a week. So how do you incorporate that practice?
You have to work with a teacher. There's no way around it. I've often, whether it be a parent or a teacher, the main thing to address is when that practice is going to occur. And I try and do it when the child, for example, comes into the classroom, when there's that time that everyone's hustling and getting things ready and doing their own thing to some degree. There's 5 minutes right there because it's not instructional time. And there is, you know, the kids are fresh. And my homework does not take more than 2 minutes. And it's fun. It's done usually on a dry erase worksheet so that, you know, there's no photocopying of papers that have to be done. They just, you know, take out their dry erase sheet. They practice the letters and they're done. It has to be also very repetitive, very easy to execute. And you take away the task, or, you know, that it's burdensome on perhaps a teacher. And also make it the child's responsibility. Bribery is a good idea where currently I have a child working, you know, every, you know, actually we've extended to every, you know, month now, but he gets a Mountain Dew if he's, you know, got all his work checked off by the teacher. And so it's his responsibility to get those checks done.
All right. All right. So I like the idea of definitely finding that time with the teacher. A lot of our students will be in general education, but maybe they also go to the RSP resource specialist teacher or something like that. That's someone I will often collaborate with. A lot of times in RSP, there's multiple kids in like a small group, and I find that they do have some downtime. And so I will use that kind of to our, hey, you know what? Is there any downtime in between two groups or whatever where Johnny can just do the alphabet a few times? Here's a fidget spinner. He can even use this fidget spinner as a, you know, sand clock or whatever, you know, right. The whole, what are those called? The sand timers? I don't even know.
Sand timer. Yeah.
Is that what they're called?
Egg timer. An egg timer.
Is that what it is?
Perhaps. I don't know.
I don't know. But anyways, basically they're using a fidget as their, fidget spinner as their timer, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, you know, and that's something that we can collaborate with on a teacher, and that could potentially replace a 30-minute one-time-a-week direct treatment with that child. Mm-hmm. It may not. You may still need to do that direct treatment, but over time, a lot of OTs ask me, what do you do with consults? And these are ideas that what you could do with consults, right? You could be working with the teacher to put something in place in the classroom.
Right. I've also used the time where my student where I've initially done like a direct session with them and then go into the classroom and the student gets to teach the class. Ooh. Or their small group. And they're sharing the stories or the letter formations with the whole class. The teachers love it. They actually will often say, really, that's how I form a D? I never knew. And, you know, we'll have a lesson inside the classroom or the small group where they get to then retell what they've learned. And that's, you know, a really functional way to get them to appreciate their learning, to solidify it.
Great. Awesome. Thanks for that. I like that idea, right? Let the student become the teacher.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Love it. All right. So we have two more overarching topics that I wanted to discuss today. One is assessments, and then the other is I want to really dive into your handwriting program a little bit. So starting with the assessments, now I know it has become pretty popular belief, right, that the VMI, the BOT2, some of those assessments that don't even, yeah, you use a pencil to complete it, but it has nothing to do with writing tasks, don't really relate to handwriting. Sure. I think you have more information on that.
Right. I definitely used to, I guess, like as a younger therapist, depend on those assessments. And I think what has happened, they haven't necessarily been updated, especially, you know, post-pandemic. So I will often find improvements, functional improvements in legibility and fluency, for example. And then when I've reassessed my student with an assessment. They're still in the first percentile, but they have the best handwriting in the classroom. So it's not necessarily telling the right story. The same way that, the VMI shapes, for example, aren't exactly prescriptive of success with with handwriting. And, it brings up another sort of myth, perhaps, that you need to have those 7 or 8 developmental shapes in place before you start handwriting. I often find that is a barrier to have these children essentially waiting when their peers are moving along and learning how to handwrite. And then they're just further behind because they don't know how to make the diagonal line. And so, as OTs, we're still working on pre-writing and making a triangle when the rest of the class has moved on and they're working on the alphabet. And that's where, what we had spoken about previously, where letter formation doesn't necessarily have to be a paper pencil activity, where we can do it with other means. And just the speed of that has to hasten. We can't necessarily rely on, what's so-called developmentally appropriate. It has to be more functionally appropriate as well, so that kids can get on par with their peers. But, to get back to the assessments, I think, pairing it with a standardized assessment is fine, as long as you're not counting on that assessment to give you too much information regarding handwriting.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you ever use another tool that we've talked about a lot, or a few, are the Etch and the THSR, some of the handwriting assessments? I know the THSR is standardized, the Etch is not, but they at least look at handwriting.
I find them, to be long to administer. And so I don't personally use them. I have developed something called the Quick Handwriting Assessment. And it's literally just a dictation task and a copying task. The dictation task looks at the letters in their letter family so that one can pick out which, there's oftentimes like a letter family that a child is struggling with. They may be struggling with the letters that start like C or, the diagonal letters. And by doing them in those groups, I quickly pull out which letter group that child might be struggling with. And then the copying task I do, it's a 1-minute copying task, and that gives me information on speed and fluency, and to see if, that's a real barrier for the child. So right. I guess I've moved away from standardized testing just in favor of speed.
For the handwriting part of it, at least.
Exactly.
Okay, very cool. Now, one last part of the assessment process, I guess you could call it, that I want to talk about, because, we've already discussed a little bit, right, is digital IT. Digitalization, if I can say that right. People are going every which way. There's so many ways to get your words onto paper without a pencil these days, right? You can do speech to text. You can use a stylus potentially. You can, there's a variety, typing. So do you do evaluations at all to the point where you're trying to figure out, should I focus more on going digital as opposed to writing? Do you do that, or do you really focus on the handwriting part?
110%. I actually, I will say that I, when I initially encountered, children struggling with handwriting, my inclination was to completely veer towards assistive technology, so much so that I did a master's degree in technology in special ed. And for another time, but I developed an application called AbilityPad. It was for the iPad. And that worked on, that was word prediction, and it was on a keyboard that one could modify and so on. Oh. So I really, love assistive technology. I see it as a wonderful answer, especially for kids with dysgraphia, with regards to word prediction, text to speech, speech to text. I think it's you know, I think being struggling with handwriting in today's world is much easier than, you know, had you been around 10 years ago with the same condition. And it's definitely an outlet for the kids who need it. I obviously sort of went back to handwriting. And the reason why that happened was I did notice what a big difference it made, even if a child could write their name. And, you know, in terms of self-esteem, kids want to be able to write their name. And then, you know, the same was true with the association of reading and writing. If kids understand the letter form, there's a kinesthetic connection with reading. And that importance to me was, you know, significant.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I actually wanted to bring this up because in my email box the other day, I actually popped into my email box with an email from you. It's an auto sequence email from you,
right.
But it is a very helpful one that comes as part of being on your email list. And it was the three reasons why you focus on handwriting, even in this digital age. And so the three reasons were, and I'll let you elaborate on these, were it leads to increased memory. Handwriting does. It uses more brain power than typing. And then your third reason was actually writing by hand benefits the whole body. And I thought those were three great things. So I wanted to bring them up and actually kind of let you, I mean, you already kind of alluded to a little bit of that, but I'd love to have you elaborate a little bit more.
Right. Well, these are all from, you know, actual studies that were conducted. And one of the authors and researchers that I love reading is studies by Virginia Berninger. And she's done a lot of work with handwriting and the brain. And she's basically made real advances that show the connection between handwriting and how, for example, students will remember more when they're taking notes when they're handwriting than when they're typing. So when you're typing, you act more as you're just taking notes, whereas because you can't write as quickly as you type, you have to sort of summarize what you've written, and therefore you're thinking about what the lecturer has said. And you're making, you know, a consolidated or summarized version of that note. So it's a more active process. So, yeah, that, you know, comes into using more brain power and improves your memory. And the benefits for the whole body, yeah, it increases the way, again, because it's a kinesthetic activity. It increases that. I'm not sure if you've ever sort of rewritten notes just for the sake of learning, or highlighted or repeated, you know, writing a word. That's a kinesthetic learning mechanism. So it's all really beneficial. I just remembered as well, in terms of assessments, I just want to go back to that.
Uh-huh.
Because there is, you know, one assessment I do want to mention that I think brings things together a lot more functionally. It's also, I don't believe it's standardized at all, but it's the DaCosta writing protocol. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of it. I've never used it.
So basically it looks at writing as writing the task, and it helps you decide which tools are going to best serve the student. So, and it recognizes that the student might do better with paper and pencil in one scenario, huh, and with keyboarding or word prediction in another. And it allows you to sort of do the composition tasks, the dictation tasks, but it's very comprehensive. It looks at keyboarding speed versus handwriting speed and really takes a functional stance on what is going to be the best option in different scenarios for the child. So, for example, and I often say to a student, you're fine doing your spelling list in the handwritten form. Anything beyond that, maybe you want to consider keyboarding the activity. Or you can do 4 to 5 sentences. Beyond that, you want to start looking at the keyboard as an option. So I think it offers that kind of thinking process.
Yeah. And that's something that we as OT should be doing in general, right? Like, if a kid's just going to write their name, it makes no sense to bust out a computer, open up word processor, write your name, press the print button.
Yes.
But if you're going to do a longer paragraph or essay, then maybe it becomes more worth the effort to get out the computer and whatnot. So great. I love that. Thanks for sharing.
And also, and the child again needs to become, like, especially by second or third grade, when the writing load becomes a lot more, they have to start self-advocating, because oftentimes the teacher isn't familiar with word prediction or with speech to text, and the child needs to take more of a role in advocating for themselves.
I mean, let's be fair. A second grader knows more about an iPhone, an iPad, and a Chromebook than any teacher does. So
Exactly. Makes sense.
Right. All righty. Great. Well, you know what? I want to transition to our last topic for the day, which is your Handwriting Heroes program. And I think a great way to actually make this transition is talking a little bit about how you got to where you were. Because if I remember right, your Handwriting Heroes program started out as an app, and we were just talking about some digital stuff, and you've kind of have transitioned away from an app, and it's, you have a computer system now, right?
Well, I think, that's essentially just a matter of where technology has gone. There's been a shift from iPads to Chromebooks, not
specifically when it comes to schools, right? They're using Chromebooks.
Exactly. So that was just from a, in terms of what I did learn through this whole process of becoming a, you know, a designer and a developer. Not that I do any of the coding myself. I'm just the idea person behind it. But that these things change. So it's not as though you can create something and just let it go. It needs constant nurturing, constant updates. And it was basically out of necessity, because of that, you know, major switch from iPads to Chromebooks within the school system, that I had to go web-based. And so it wasn't, you know, and I'm currently, hopefully soon, relaunching the app version as well.
Oh, awesome.
So that, because I, you know, I really like the tactile nature of the iPad. I enjoy it more than the Chromebook screen interface. But essentially, the content has remained the same. And I the methodology obviously has remained the same throughout.
Gotcha. Great. So then, why don't you share with us a little bit about Handwriting Heroes program, just kind of an overarching, for someone who's never heard of it, how do you like to share about it?
Sure. Well, it's a multi-sensory handwriting program. It's used, you know, in individually or in classrooms. And as you might guess, it starts with lowercase letter formations. And then we practice lowercase for it's taught in 5 weeks. There's five letter groups, and it's taught in 5 weeks, which gives the child the opportunity to start writing right when they finished that 5 week program, but also has then approximately 10 weeks of a print practice where we do activities like that alphabet, the alphabet speed activities and working on words and short phrases. And then lastly, I teach uppercase over a period of 6 weeks. So the program takes about 21 weeks, and it can be modified for, you know, and differentiated, but primarily I like to get that 5 week done as quickly as possible to give the kids the tools that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. And so is this geared more toward OTs, more toward teachers, parents, all the above? What would you say?
Well, all the above. I really, you know, do feel like teachers need to reclaim the responsibility for handwriting. And one of the benefits of the program is that it is something that can be taught as a whole group in a classroom. So there are strategies that lend it two whole group teaching, and you know, whether it be the videos where the videos can be shown to the whole group, or air writing where a classroom teacher can observe all the children air writing at one time. And then at the same time, it works nicely in a home environment, one-on-one, or a homeschool environment where the child can just navigate their way through the game independently.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. And I mean, I took a look at it. I did the free trial, and I saw like some of the videos that you've got going on, some of the games you've got. You use the sky, the clouds, the grass and the dirt analogy that I know some people use. And so I guess my question is, you said it's multisensory. Just explain a little bit about all the different ways that you made this multisensory.
Sure. So basically, I've embedded multisensory strategies throughout the program. So for auditory learners, each group has a theme song that emphasizes the common stroke. And each letter, as I mentioned, has a story that explains why the letters are formed the way they are. The students can retell the story as they form the letter to help them order the strokes. So for example, K skydives down, a little bird kisses K and flies away. And if you saw that in your mind's eye, you would understand the stroke sequence. And so it provides a rationale for why the strokes occur in that sequence. Then for visual learners, the images and the videos, especially the slapstick moments, are very engaging for kids. And then for kinesthetic learners, lots of finger tracing and air writing to stimulate the multi-memory paths to make learning the letters very efficient. I'll also say, in terms of the kinesthetic learners, there's five letter groups. So just like, other programs have used letter groupings, we've got it done in story format. The skydivers, L, T, K, I, J, they all skydive down. The bouncers are H, B, R, N, M, P, and they drop down, bounce back up and over. The cannon pops are the ones that start like C and so on. And I think I should also, make note that a differentiator is that I have all those letters practiced at once. So the emphasis is on learning the common stroke, but also understanding the differences within the groups. And it makes, essentially, instead of taking five letters and writing, focusing on one letter each day of the week, we're going to focus on the entire group for the whole week. So the kids write L, T, K, I, J. And oftentimes people will say, well, you can't like introduce five letters at once. This child's in kindergarten. And I'm like, it's never not worked. it's just never not worked. It doesn't matter who the child is, what their disability is. I might alter the output mechanism that they're using. So I might, have them do it in sand or foam or, something that's more appealing than a pencil and paper, but they can learn that L skydives down, he lands on a lemon, T skydives down, a toucan tosses a tomato, and they see the stories. It's like watching a short cartoon for them, and they're practicing that core group every day of the week. Then the next group gets introduced the following week, and you still review those initial five, which takes all of 10 seconds to write at that point.
Awesome. That's great. So you've got it chunked into smaller groups, but rather than doing one a day, you recommend kind of working on all of them together so that they can kind of see the differences between them in real time, really.
Right. And it's just something that, has proven to be manageable for the children and very effective. It's also builds that like motor memory without being repetitious. So I find that if you have a child doing R 10 times, there's no real point in that. They get sort of you know, the brain sort of blocks it out eventually, and they're just sort of being repetitive without, you know, being active learners.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Awesome. And so handwritingheroes.org, that's the website. If someone goes over there, what can they expect to find without even having to pay a single dollar? What do you have over there?
So they can sign up for a free week-long trial, as you did. And with that, you'll be able to basically execute the first full week of the program, being the skydivers. And just to get a sense of that, the workbook is available for the practice pages, and all the videos are available for the skydiver letters. So you'll be able to just get a real feel for the program and get a sense of whether your child or your class enjoys it.
I love it. Yeah. And I mean, I'm even on the page right now, even before you sign up for a free trial, there's a lot of different ideas that you can draw from it just by looking at many of the pictures and animations you have on the website before you even sign up for a free trial. Something like the finger puppets that I'm looking at right now, right? Mm-hmm. Making a little finger puppet to trace the letters. That's a great idea just in itself.
Right. And the kids love that. It's something that's used in the pre-K classrooms and in the kindergarten classrooms, where it just animates the process and it makes air writing real fun. So they can take that to essentially a different level.
Absolutely. Well, for everyone out there listening and you want to check out Handwriting Heroes, it is at handwritingheroes.org. Cheryl, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it. Is there any last words that you would like to share with any OT listening today?
Just to work with your classroom teachers and to enjoy the process of being, you know, of being involved in this process of handwriting, and to look more carefully at the students and what their needs are, not to, you know, just confine it to whether or not something is legible. Look beyond that, so, you know, so that you can help that child functionally.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all the wonderful tips. I really do think that some people are going to leave today just having so much more in their OT, you know, that tool chest or whatever you want to call it, right? In their OT toolbox today. So thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here. And I look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks, Jason. Likewise.
Thank you so much for sticking around all the way to the end of the episode. I really hope that the conversation between myself and Cheryl really helped you to reevaluate a little bit about what you know about handwriting. It was really eye-opening to me, especially when we talked about the starting with lowercase versus uppercase letters, because I do see that, right? We see kids that get fixated on using uppercase letters, and we're trying to teach them those lowercase letters, and it's just not happening. So if we know that a student might have difficulty with generalizing or maybe learning multiple variations on a single item, then maybe we should be starting with the lowercase letters first and introducing uppercase letters as needed. Anyways, I hope this episode really helped you to maybe rethink or at least question some of the things that you know about handwriting, the instruction that you do with the students, and what you teach to the teachers. With that, enjoy the rest of your day, the rest of your week, and I will see you next time on the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the OT Schoolhouse Podcast. For more ways to help you and your students succeed right now, head on over to otschoolhouse.com. Until next time, class is dismissed.